8,000 years of human history. That's a long way in the future. Peter the object is to bracket the millennium. We know what we have now. We know the conditions that have prevailed down through the 6,000 years of human history. And if we know what is going to happen after the millennium, then we have bracketed the millennium itself, right? And what is not to be accomplished until after the millennium definitely should not be expected during the millennium at all. The reason for this consideration is that we shouldn't become discouraged because things are developing slower than we had expected, particularly than we had wished. We have done a lot of wishful thinking in terms of the millennium. That's all right as long as discouragement doesn't set in. But discouragement has set in. And brethren have been disillusioned about what should be transpiring at the present time. And the result is that they are changing their ideas and putting off the kingdom of heaven. So really, we want to get a good look at the millennium. What we should expect in the millennium. And if we are expecting the right thing, we will not be disappointed. That's my feeling. Maybe it's the nature of my work that leads me to this approach. As you know, I work on office machines, bookies machines, and assessments are required from time to time. For instance, if our analysis of a certain trouble would indicate that an eccentric should be turned, we can aggravate the trouble by turning it the opposite way from which you think it should go. This usually proves the analysis is correct. Then you can turn the eccentric, correcting the original trouble, and keep turning it and trying the machine until you run into some other trouble. You then strike about in the middle, so you have a margin of safety on both sides. We think there is something in the military. We're not giving a plug to the military in this, but just for purposes of illustration. They say, look out for the third shell. Why do they say that? Well, they will fire one shell. You see, the elevation is important. The horizontal is relatively easy. But the vertical aim is the critical thing. It will be almost impossible to hit the target on the first shot. They're not too concerned about that. They notice how many yards short or over it is. Then they will make a correction. They may overcorrect it. But it doesn't matter because once they find out how far one setting on the sight goes above this target and the other setting goes below the target, they have the target calibrated then and look out for the third one. They can zero in on the third one. That's what we're trying to do here. We know the present situation. If we can determine something about the eighth day, we really can zero in on the millennium, and that's critical subject of the present time. Now I'd say that another basic text in this lesson is 1 Corinthians 15, verses 22 to 28. You know, we hear this at funerals. We are very familiar with it. But we think that in this chapter is the key to the correct understanding of the millennium, the object of the millennium. Well, someone might say the millennium is a time when we will have peace and tranquility, when righteousness will prevail. But that's not a precise description of the millennium. That will be more true after the millennium, for the ages to follow. So if you are describing the millennium, you shouldn't use language that would apply even more completely to another age or to the eternity that's going to follow. Of course, we know that in the millennium, conditions are going to be radically changed. But if you want to get a precise definition of the work of the millennial age, you can't get anything better than what the Apostle Paul says. He says the object of the millennium is to put down enemies. And when you say it's the age in which enemies are put down, you have hit the nail right on the head. That is the only age in which enemies are put down. Certainly the enemies have not been put down during the 6,000 years of human history. Malachi's prophecy, the first chapter, certainly applies. Quote, now we call the proud happy, yea, they that work wickedness and set up, yea, they that tempt God or even deliver, end quote. That has been the condition all down through the 6,000 years. So the enemies have not been put down in the past. Now I submit that enemies will not be put down after the millennium, or rather after the little season following the millennium. Enemies will not be put down after that. Why? Because there simply won't be any. The enemies will all have been destroyed. And you know, the pastor has emphasized this thought, particularly in the last years of his ministry, that the Lord's Prayer, "Thy kingdom come, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven," will not be answered during the millennium age, not completely. For God's will not be done on earth precisely as it is done in heaven during the millennial age, any part of it. Because God's will is not done in heaven with potential enemies standing on the sidelines in restraint, as there will be on earth during the millennium. The enemies have all been banished from heaven. The devil himself was banished from heaven to this earth. The evil spirits were banished to try to rule, which we would understand to be the environment of this earth. Man himself, in the very nature of things, has been confined to this earth and its satellites, the moon. So you might say this earth is a veritable devil's island. And while conditions will be improved and that evil will be restrained in the millennial age, the enemies will still be here. So God's will not be done on this earth precisely as it is in heaven until after the little season following the millennial age. You see, that emphasizes the same thought, that it is the eighth day which will bring about the ideal conditions and the full answer to the Lord's Prayer, "Thy kingdom come." And I don't say, Brother Harvey, why do you give such a discouraging thought as that? Here I thought the millennium was going to bring about perfection. It's all right if you think that way, providing you don't get discouraged if it doesn't develop as fast as we would like to have it. That's the trouble with wishful thinking. We have to be realistic about it and expect the right thing. As I said before, if we expect the right thing, we will not be disappointed at the conditions that prevail in the world today. Zechariah, the 14th chapter, verses 6 and 7, gives much the same thought. After speaking of the deliverance of Israel, he will gather all nations to Jerusalem and fight for them as in the days of old. Then coming down to the 6th and 7th verses, we read, "And it shall come to pass," that is, after Jacob's trouble, "in that day," the whole millennial age, "that the light shall not be clear nor dark, but it shall be one day which shall be known to the Lord, not day nor night, but it shall come to pass that at evening time it shall be light." This is a description of the millennial age. It starts out as a dark day. But it's not only dark, it is accompanied by a thunderstorm, lightning and hail, and all these highly symbolic features. And then it gradually gets light. It will soon be lighter than man had ever imagined. But that's not good enough for the Lord. He's going to go right on. And so it is true that, quote, "I have not seen or ear heard, neither have entered into the heart of man the things which God has in reservation for them that love him," end quote. While man would soon feel that this is better than we have ever had it before, this is utopia, God will only be beginning his great work. He is going to root out every trace of Adamic weakness in the hearts of man. And so, quote, "the last enemy that shall be destroyed is death." We would like to read a few verses in 1 Corinthians 15, previously referred to, because we want to emphasize this thought. Beginning with verse 22. "For as in Adam all die, even so in Christ shall all be made alive, but every man in his own order. Christ the first fruit," plural, Christ and his church, "afterwards they that are Christ at his coming," that is, during his presence, the whole period of his presence. "Then cometh the end." The end of what? The end of his coming? No, the end of his presence. "When he shall have delivered up the kingdom to God, even the Father. Why hasn't he turned it over to the Father before? Why isn't it turned over to the Father at the beginning of the millennium? Simply because it isn't acceptable. When he shall have put down all rule and all authority and power. Now, here is the object of the millennium, the inspired word of the Apostle Paul. For he must reign till he has put all enemies under his feet. Now, that's the precise, accurate, and exclusive definition of the work of the millennium. The last enemy that shall be destroyed is death. That is Adamic death. Every trace of hereditary weakness has to be eliminated from the heart of every individual who has suffered as a result of Adam's transgression. They have to be equally benefited by the redemptive work of Christ. Continuing, for he hath put all things under his feet, but when he saith all things are put under him, it is manifest that he is accepted, which did put all things under him. Now naturally, it doesn't mean that God is put under him. And when all things shall be subdued under him, then shall the Son also himself be subject to him that put all things under him, that God may be all in all. This is at the end of the millennium. I think we are all agreed on that. This is not any advanced thought. This is not any different thought. These are elementary lessons right in the divine plan if we just try to remember them. We have never been taught that the beginning of the millennium would usher in a world of perfection. Here in the first volume, page 67, Epochs and Dispensations, one of the most elementary lessons in the divine plan, this is what we read, quote, the last two of these worlds are most particularly mentioned, and the statements relative to them are in strong contrast. The present, or second period, is called the present evil world, not because there is nothing good in it, but because in it evil is permitted to predominate. Now we call the proud happy, they that work wickedness are set up, they that tempt God are even delivered. Malachi 3:15. The third world or epoch is mentioned as the world to come wherein dwelleth righteousness. Not because there will be no evil in it, but because evil will not predominate. The blotting out of evil will be gradual, requiring all of the first 1,000 years. 1,000 years of what? Of the ages to come, wherein dwelleth righteousness. The 1,000 years is the mind. Continuing to quote, evil will not rule then. It will not prosper. It will no longer be the wicked that will flourish, but the righteous shall flourish. Psalm 72:7. The obedient shall eat the good of the land. Isaiah 1:19. And the evildoer shall be cut off. Psalm 37:9. Again, this is in the first volume, page 67. Again, on page 241, I read here from these elemental lessons in the divine plan to show that this is not a new idea that I'm presenting here at all. This is what we should have learned in our early study of the divine plan of the ages. Quote, their restoration to perfect human nature, as well as out of the world in general, will be a gradual work, requiring all of the millennial age for its full accomplishment. During that 1,000 years reign of Christ, the result of Adamic death will be gradually swallowed up or destroyed. Its various stages, sickness, pain, and weakness, as well as the tomb, will yield obedience to the great restorer's power, until at the end of that age, as the millennial age, the great pyramid of our charge will be complete. End quote. There are many other references on this point, but I think that will suffice. We could refer to the 1916 foreword of the third volume, in which Brother Russell says that the millennium is called God's kingdom, and it is Messiah's kingdom. But while it will be under the supervision of the Messiah, it will not be God's kingdom in the full sense of the word until the end of the millennial age. So if you want the pastor's latest thought as an endorsement of what I'm saying here, you will find it in the foreword of the third volume, page 3, paragraph 3. We might illustrate the work of the millennium in various ways. Christ, like a great general contractor, permits the wrecking crew, and that wrecking crew is described on page 550 of the fourth volume, particularly paragraph 3. He permits the wrecking crew to demolish everything based on injustice and evil before he sends in the construction workers, which would be the glorified little flock, the great company, and the ancient worthy. That does not mean that the Lord is responsible for everything that's being done by the wrecking crew. You can imagine a general contractor who wouldn't spend much time supervising the wrecking crew. He would just look in on them once in a while, and perhaps they don't get too rough and careless. He's not responsible for everything they do. They simply want to do what he wants done at a given time. That's the only sense in which they are the Lord's great army. See volume 4, page 550, paragraph 3. The Lord's people are not to have anything to do with that part of the battle on either side. We must not be polarized in this situation. We certainly cannot uphold Babylon and the old order, and we certainly could not enter fully into an endorsement of what is being done by those who are tearing it down. Then we would be polarized, and personally, I think if I might digress slightly at this point, I think that is what is meant by the River Jordan being divided. The River Jordan is being divided, right and left. But Elijah went down the middle and walked on dry ground. If you are not polarized today, you are practically isolated. Now see the second volume, page 262, a very significant reference, where the pastor emphasizes this thought that the Lord's people are not to have any part in the physical aspect of the battle. And we would probably be the only ones who would not be polarized. I saw a cartoon just recently in the paper, and it showed four magnets. And the title of it was, It's Hard to Walk Around and Not Be Polarized These Days. And here these four magnets were, in the first place, the rich and the poor. That's one. Black and white. That's another polarization. The third was right and left. And the fourth, youth and age. We should add capital and labor. The common denominator was the haves and the have-nots. The right and the left. And the River Jordan is being divided to the right and to the left. Not only in respect to religious truth, but truths along every line. This is important to consider. It is truth along every line that is having a part in the battle. See volume 2, page 101, paragraph 3, page 147, paragraph 2, and page 165 at the bottom of the page. These are all references in the second volume. I believe that this dividing work is going on, and we must avoid being polarized and involved in that part of the struggle. It's hard for me to believe that we have been standing on the banks of the River Jordan for 60 years. It seems to me that this work has been going on, and it's truth along every line that is dividing the people. It's not only truth along religious lines, but truth along scientific lines, truth along social lines, political lines, you see. And it's hard to find anybody that is neutral nowadays. And they're becoming very emphatic, too, in the position that they take. We are a part of the construction crew, you see. And the development and training of the construction crew, even the recruiting of new members for the construction crew, can be going on while the wrecking crew is busy at work. Is that true? Now, that's a pretty good illustration. Another one is this. The Lord speaks of Babylon's quack doctrine. Quote, they have healed the hurt of the daughter of my people slightly, saying, peace, peace, when there is no peace. Jeremiah 6:14. Christ has a good physician and surgeon will figuratively lance the wound and scrape the bone in order to effect a real cure. Two different approaches to the same problem, aren't they? Who is a good physician? Well, this is what the Lord says, Hosea 6, 1 and 2. Come and let us return unto the Lord, for he hath torn and he will heal us. He hath smitten and he will bind us up. That refers to Israel. After 2 days he will revive us. In the third day, the 3,000-year day after their rejection, the last of the fifth, all of the sixth, and part of the seventh, he will raise us up. That's being done, isn't it? Now there is another one. Quote, the Lord shall smite Egypt. Egypt, of course, is symbolic of the world. He shall smite and heal it. Isaiah 19:22. Now this is the same passage that refers to the Great Pyramid, the witness in the land of Egypt. That's significant. The time when this pyramid begins to speak, that's the time when the Lord is going to wound the world with a view to a sound, permanent cure of the malady. This also emphasizes the work of the millennium as, first of all, being a more or less destructive work. The surgeon seems as though he is destroying something, but he is merely displaying the traits of a real physician and surgeon. He is not the quack doctor. You know, the quack doctors have been binding up the wound, putting on salve, and saying everything is going to be all right. Infection gets worse and worse. The patient's life is threatened. Then the good physician steps in and says, you've tried your method. We've got to take over. That is what the Lord is doing. He may seem cruel to start with, but he knows best. The same thought is true of a good dentist. He drills the cavity larger to remove the decay in order to put in a permanent filling. Is that true? This well illustrates the two parts of the kingdom work. Suppose you went into a dentist's office and said, Doctor, I wish you would fill this cavity. What does he do? Does he take a filling or medication and put it in the tooth? No, he gets the ugly drill out. If you thought you had a cavity before, you haven't seen anything yet. You know, the tongue is very sensitive to the size of the cavity, and pretty soon you think you drilled the whole tooth away. And it's getting more painful all the time, especially if you have neglected it too long, and certainly the world has neglected it too long. There's going to be some pain as you get down near the nerves. The Lord is a good dentist. He's not going to save the drill and have this decay come back again. This is going to be a thorough job. But now this is the hopeful thought. What a comfort it is to see him hang up the drill and put the medication in, the pain stops right away. Then he puts in the filling and restores what has been lost. And here is restitution, in the narrow sense. But you see the relationship of this constructive part of the restitution to the destructive part. They are both part of the same operation. The same dentist is doing both jobs. He calls it drilling the tooth, and so bills you. So this is all restitution in its broader meaning. And in the meantime, the true kingdom is being set up, the heavenly faith. Though we are in the early dawn of millennial day, the clouds of trouble obscure the light from the sun of righteousness. The sun does not actually come up at this day. But if you've been up early in the morning, you know it gets daylight a couple of hours before the sun comes up. I believe that is the situation. In 1874, the dawn of the millennial day began. And it soon was so bright, it fooled almost everybody. The Christian magazine, The Christian Century, adopted that name at the dawn of this century. They were so optimistic because of the flood of inventions that came in the last 25 years of the 19th century that they were sure that they had the world completely under control at that time. That they would convert the heathen in this country. Well, at the halfway point, the Christian Century magazine admitted that they had certainly been over-optimistic. It wasn't even going in that direction. But they had an alibi, and this is significant. They went to the trouble of going through their files for that period when they adopted the name to see if there were any that objected to it at that time. They found not a single letter in their files that anyone objected to that optimistic viewpoint. But if they had listened a little closer, they would have heard a lone voice crying in the wilderness. The pastor had been telling them that, quote, the morning cometh, but a dark night also, end quote, on the masthead of the watchtower. So it is like the storm clouds that come even after the dawn has begun. The clouds can get so dark that anyone awakening in the middle of that thunderstorm would swear that the morning had not even begun to dawn. That's the situation we are in now. And even some brethren are losing sight of the fact that the millennial age began in 1874. But you know, once the storm is over, it will be lighter than ever. Then the sun will actually come up. And that's what we can look forward to in the near future. You know, this isn't such a pessimistic viewpoint after all. The surgery is almost over. It's pretty well along anyway. And then comes the recovery in the hospital. And how nice it is every day to get better and better, pretty soon to get up and around. That is what we have to look forward to, which is wonderful. The world will feel better than it ever has in the past very soon after the trouble is over, and then they will go on to greater and greater blessings. Now we would like to emphasize what the type has to say. We don't use type to teach a doctrine. We think we have proved the point pretty well. Rather, we have reminded ourselves of what has been proved. We think we have established this from the Scriptures, from the wise and faithful servant, from reason alone, and from the physical facts all about it. So now let's look to the type to see how the type has portrayed this very thing and has emphasized the importance of the eighth day as being the ultimate in the achievement of God's purposes of blessing the world. In Exodus, the 22nd chapter, verses 29 to 31, we read, Thou shalt not delay to offer the first of thy ripe fruit, and of thy liquor. The firstborn of thy sons shalt thou give unto me. Likewise shalt thou do with thine oxen, and with thy sheep. 7 days it shall be with his dam. On the eighth day thou shalt give it me, and he shall be holy men unto me. End quote. The Lord wouldn't accept them until the eighth day. The animals that were dedicated to the Lord and the sons of the Israelites were to be dedicated on the eighth day. Now this will, of course, come up a little farther on in our study. In Leviticus, the 22nd chapter, the 27th verse, we have practically a repetition of the one in Exodus, chapter 22, that we just read. Quote, when a bullock or a sheep or a goat is brought forth, then it shall be 7 days under the dam, and from the eighth day and thenceforth. The eighth day and thenceforth, beginning with the eighth day, the age after the millennium, and from thenceforth the world will be the Lord's, not before in the seventh day. Continuing to quote, it shall be accepted for an offering made by fire unto the Lord. End quote. Leviticus, the 14th chapter, you have a comment Bible. I suggest you turn to the comment on Leviticus 14, verses 2, 9, and 10. This shall be the law of the leper in the day of his cleansing. It shall be brought unto the priest. This is the cleansing of the leper.
It is very promising because leprosy is particularly a symbol of sin and death. It was incurable, and they were banished from society when they had leprosy. This is the ceremony prescribed for the cleansing of the leper. What was the ceremony? Verse 9. But it shall be on the seventh day that he shall shave all his hair off his head, and his beard, and his eyebrows. Even all his hair he shall shave off. He shall wash his clothes. Also he shall wash his flesh in water, and he shall be clean. End quote. When will all this happen? All this cleansing would happen on the seventh day. The seventh day is the millennium. Now, this is the preparation for something. See verses 10 and 11. Quote, and on the eighth day shall take two he lambs without blemish, and 3/10 deals of fine flour from a meat for a meat offering. And the priest that maketh him clean shall present the man that is to be made clean, and those things before the Lord at the door of the tabernacle of the congregation. End quote. Now when is this? On the eighth day. Again in verse 23. And he shall bring them on the eighth day for his cleansing unto the priest, unto the door of the tabernacle of the congregation before the Lord. End quote. When the priest accepted these sacrifices, he was accepting them on behalf of Jehovah, wasn't he? And when will Jehovah accept the leprous world of mankind? On the eighth day following the seventh day of their cleansing. When we talk about cleansing, gravitating to purely physical aspects of this, it's remarkable how much stress is placed on physical cleansing in our time, the seventh day. It seems to be the most profitable merchandising right now to produce the better cleansers, the better washing compounds. You know, they have whiter than white. They must lie awake nights thinking up new slogans to stress cleaning. Well, that's wonderful. Of course, it only points up the weak links in the chain. That is their mental and moral filthiness. But what do we expect at this stage? The resurrection of the dead, changing the hearts of men, must await the availability of the merit of the ransom for the world. The curse was added to the death penalty. It turned out to be a blessing for mankind. Now the partial lifting of the curse, labor-saving devices, etc., while potential money or blessings are temporarily a curse. Can't we take heart, however, in the fact that cleansing of any nature is taking place, that they are learning a lot about these things, and they're making efforts to eliminate the evils of smoking and things of that nature. We hope it keeps on in that direction. But I can see the evidence of cleansing being stressed at the present time. You know, this world is not all bad. I think it has never been more true what was said of the French Revolution, which was itself a type or a figure of the time of trouble on a bigger scale. That, quote, it was the best of times and it was the worst of times, end quote. So the present situation, it's a grand and at the same time an awful time. I am glad I can see both aspects of it. Of course, there is room for an argument on the subject. Take a glass and you can say it's half full of water, or you can say it's half empty. Both statements would be true. But one would reflect a pessimistic viewpoint and the other an optimistic. If you say it's half empty, you would be a pessimist, right? If you say it's half full, you would be an optimist. Quote, the difference between an optimist and a pessimist is quite droll. The optimist sees the donut, and the pessimist sees the hole. This is a confusing period of time to be living in. And the Word of God helps us to understand it, and above all, to see hope for the future. But not everything all at once. Not everything in the next 10 years. Not everything in the next 50 years. Not everything in the next 100 years. It's going to take the rest of the 1,000 years to bring about the full release of mankind from evil. We could be 1,000 years off in our expectations. See also Leviticus 15, verses 13 to 15, and Leviticus 15, verses 28 to 31. Now all these emphasize the same thought, cleansing on the seventh day, and the bringing of the sacrifice to the Lord, which represents their consecration to the Lord, giving themselves to the Lord, and the acceptance by the priest on the eighth day. In a slightly different vein, we have Leviticus 23, verses 34 to 36. Speak unto the children of Israel, saying, 15th day of this seventh month shall be the Feast of Tabernacles, for 7 days unto the Lord. On the first day shall be an holy convocation, shall do no servile work therein. 7 days shall offer an offering made by fire unto the Lord. On the eighth day shall be an holy convocation unto you. He shall offer an offering made by fire unto the Lord. It is a solemn assembly, and he shall do no servile work therein. Quote. Now, doesn't that seem to suggest that on the first day of human creation, it started out as a holy convocation? It started out innocent and holy, didn't it? But that didn't last very long. Adam himself left the scene before the end of the first day. Then there were to be no more holy days, strictly speaking, until the eighth day. It sort of relegates the millennium into a category of an age of imperfection, doesn't it? Yet I think that is well within the framework of the plan we've already considered it. Numbers, the sixth chapter, verses 2, 9, to 11. Quote, speak unto the children of Israel and say unto them, when either man or woman shall separate themselves to vow a vow of a Nazarite, separate themselves unto the Lord. Nazarites were a very special class. They were not only dedicated, but they were holy. They were separate from the congregation in general. And there were provisions made for their cleansing. This would be very significant, very promising in teaching this lesson of cleansing. They were to avoid being in the presence of anyone who was about to die. But, of course, accidental deaths could happen. So they would be in the presence of someone when they died. And that would defile them, defile their consecration, because they were supposed to be free from death. See how promising this is. This is a picture of how to get free from the defilement of death. Verse 9. Quote, and if any man die very suddenly by him, and he hath defiled the head of his consecration, then he shall shave his head in the day of his cleansing, on the seventh day shall he shave it. And on the eighth day he shall bring two turtle doves, or two young pigeons, to the priest, to the door of the tabernacle of the congregation. End quote. On the eighth day. In this case, and other types, we see they were only marking time for 6 days. The seventh day was the time, in most cases, when the cleansing took place, which shows that the millennium is the time when the world will be cleansed of their defilement of sin and death. I think the most comprehensive picture of this whole thing, and it emphasizes other aspects of it too, is Numbers, the 29th chapter, starting verses 12 and 13. Quote, and on the 15th day of the seventh month shall have an holy convocation, shall do no servile work. He shall keep a feast unto the Lord 7 days. He shall offer a burnt offering, a sacrifice made by fire, of a sweet savor unto the Lord. 13 young bullocks, 2 rams, 14 lambs of the first year, they shall be without blemish. End quote. Think of it. On the first day, 13 bullocks, 14 lambs, and 2 rams were to be offered. Now verse 17. And on the second day he shall offer 12 young bullocks. One less bullock. Same number of rams and lambs. 2 rams and 14 lambs. That remains constant during the whole week. But the number of bullocks diminishes by 1 each day. To my mind, it suggests that God has been accomplishing something towards the atonement and salvation of the world in each 1,000 years of human history. For instance, the ancient worthies have been developed and perfected. They are a means of blessing the world, aren't they? Like the ashes of the red heifer out beyond the camp. These were for the cleansing, even of the priests. Paul says, seeing ye also are compassed about with so great a cloud of witnesses, who, these ancient worthies, let us lay aside every weight and the sin which doth so easily beset us, and let us run with patience the race that is set before us. Those ancient worthies are an example of faith to the church. And if they help the church, they are helping the plan of salvation too. But they themselves are being developed and prepared for a great work when the kingdom goes into full operation. It seems that this is an elaborate, a comprehensive picture. All the animals sacrificed here. They shouldn't go unnoticed. Were they all slain in vain that we don't get any lesson out of this? The Lord has something important here, I think. It corroborates the truths which are already clearly taught in the scriptures directly. All right, on the second day, 12 bullocks. And on the third day, verse 20, 11 bullocks, 2 rams, 14 lambs. On the fourth day, verse 23, 10 bullocks, 2 rams, and 14 lambs. Verse 26, and on the fifth day, 9 bullocks, 2 rams, and 14 lambs. Verse 29, and on the sixth day, 8 bullocks, 2 rams, and 14 lambs. And on the seventh day, 7 bullocks, 2 rams, and 14 lambs. Verse 32. Now you add these all together for the aggregate number of bullocks that was offered. You will find that at the end of the sixth day, you have 63 bullocks offered. On the seventh day, you add how many? 7 more. 7 and 63 are how many? 70. Now 70, of course, is a perfect number, isn't it? Remember Peter asked how many times should he forgive his brother? Until 7 times? The Lord said until 70 times 7. Here you have the thought of 7 bullocks, which itself is a complete number. Completion or perfection, which made a total of 70 on the seventh day, too. Look at the combination of 7s that you have here. You have 10 times 7, which is 7, 70. You have 7 being added to reach that total. And this was done on the seventh day. I think it certainly emphasizes the work that will be done. But you see, the work is not complete until the end of the seventh day. Now the picture changes. The scene changes. There is a radical change. Verses 35 and 36. Quote, on the eighth day you shall have a solemn assembly. You shall do no servile work therein. You shall offer a burnt offering, a sacrifice made by fire of a sweet savor unto the Lord, one bullock, one ram, up 2 rams, 7 lambs, up 14 as previously, the first year without blemish, end quote. Now what would this one bullock offered on the eighth day represent? Would we add that one bullock to that already perfect number of 70 and spoil the beauty of that perfect number? This is a different category entirely. This has nothing to do with the cleansing of the world. Here is an offering that is made to the Lord, not a turtle dove, not a young pigeon, not a goat or a ram, but a bullock. Now what does a bullock represent? Tabernacle study emphasizes the thought that the bullock represents the perfect humanity of Jesus a perfect man. So what would this one bullock represent then? Well, we think we have the answer in Psalm 51:19. Quote, do good in thy good pleasure under Zion. Build thou the walls of Jerusalem. Verse 18. This seems to refer to restitution completed. Anyway, then shalt thou be pleased with the sacrifices of righteousness, with burnt offerings, and whole burnt offerings. Then shall they offer bullocks upon thine altar. The world will be perfect at that time, and to represent the complete consecration of their perfect humanity, it will require a bullock. When? On the eighth day. Turning back to the covenant with Abraham, and you know the covenant was made with Abraham long before the law itself was given, of which these sacrifices were a part, as we have referred to here. There was a sign given to Abraham, a token of this covenant. Notice how it is expressed. Genesis 17, verses 7 and 8. And I will establish my covenant between me and thee, and thy seed after thee, and their generations, for an everlasting covenant. Be a God unto thee, and thy seed after thee. And I will give unto thee, and to thy seed after thee, the land wherein thou art a stranger, all the land of Canaan, for an everlasting possession, and I will be their God. End quote. Now this was the original promise to Abraham, wasn't it? Now verses 10 and 12. This is my covenant which ye shall keep, between me and you and thy seed after thee. Every man child among you shall be circumcised, and he that is 8 days old shall be circumcised among you. Every man child in your generation, he that is born in the house, or bought with money of any stranger, which is not of thy seed. Quote. You remember in the ceremonies considered earlier that they were dedicated to the Lord on the eighth day. Now this was a ceremony by which they were dedicated, presented to the Lord, circumcision. This was a hard and fast rule from that time on. This antedates the giving of the law. This is associated with the original promise that all the families of the earth should be blessed through Abraham and his seed. Why did God prescribe that this ceremony be performed on the eighth day? There probably was some biological reason why this was the best time. In fact, they've determined now that on the eighth day, a child has the maximum amount of vitamin K. That is the blood clotting vitamin. So there is less danger of hemorrhage, etc. Any surgery that might be performed. That's interesting, isn't it? But that is relatively unimportant. Why was the Lord so inflexible? Why didn't he say, if it isn't convenient, do it on the seventh day or the ninth day? Well, that wouldn't have been bad so far as the type was concerned. But look what it would have done to the antithesis. Because the antithesis for this eighth day is undoubtedly the 1,000 years following the millennium. The Lord would have allowed a variation of one day in the type, would have thrown the antithesis off a whole 1,000 years. Think of it. Millions of ceremonies emphasizing the fact that the Lord will accept the human family on the 8,000 years of human history. More than that. Every one of those who went through this ceremony, he was portraying the fact that while typically he was accepted to the Lord on the eighth day, antitypically, and in reality, he will be accepted to the Lord in the beginning of the 8,000 years. This is a comprehensive picture, isn't it? Same thought is emphasized in the pyramid, which we have taken a lot of interest in and gotten a lot of benefit from. The Queen's Chamber represents the human salvation. Heaven is below and inferior to the King's Chamber, with its granite, etc. But it also points out in the third volume, page 369, paragraph 2, that brush. You have to stoop way over to get through it. But suddenly, after 6/7 of the distance has been covered, the floor drops down. And not only gives you more space, but it becomes smooth. Isn't that a wonderful picture of the millennium, too? The stumbling stones will be gathered out. But that is not the end. That is not the reward. The Queen's Chamber itself is at the end of the last seven, the beginning of the eighth day. And that ties in with our text. Hear me, blessed of my Father, inherit the kingdom prepared for you from the foundation of the world. Just one thought in closing about the Jubilee. Someone might say, according to that then, the millennium really isn't the Jubilee. Some have gone that far, and they try to set up a contradiction. Say, we agree with what Brother Russell said in the sixth volume, but we can't see what he says in the second volume. Well, actually, there's no conflict at all. The millennium will be the grand fulfillment of Israel's Jubilee system. That is clearly shown in the second volume. That's another reason why the millennium will be Israelitish. It is just as much a part of Israel as was the Jubilee system that led up to it. But that does not preclude another thought, a grander thought on a higher scale. The age after the millennium will be the 50th thousand years of the creative week, not of human history. Is there a contradiction here? No. Because the millennium will be man's jubilee, Israel's jubilee, in which the rights and property will be transferred back to man. But it will lead up to a grander jubilee, 50,000 years of the creative week. We have a clinching point on this, I think. The whole jubilee system was predicated on the assumption that they had a possession when they went into the land, right? The land was divided up not only by tribes, but by families, so that every man had a possession at the beginning of the 50-year cycle. Now he could lose it any time during the 50 years. The creative week is bigger than man. Man wasn't even on the scene at the beginning of the creative week. Man, the first and only earthly free moral agent, was created and almost immediately got lost with his dominion on the 43rd thousand year of that higher jubilee cycle. This cycle is bigger than man, and is reserved for someone who had a possession at the beginning of the cycle, Jehovah himself. The beginning of the creative week. And when will Jehovah get this possession back? Not until after the millennium, we have seen, when Christ turns the kingdom over to the Father. 49,000 years, however, is a Sabbath in God's Jubilee cycle, as it was in the tithe. The relationship between these two Jubilees is beautifully shown in Volume 6, page 51. Quote, the whole period of 7 times 7,000 years, or 49,000 years when complete, will lead up to and introduce the great 50th, which we have already noted as prominent in the scriptures as marking grand climaxes in the divine plan. Israel's day Sabbath culminating in 7 times 7 = 49, leading to and introducing the 50th, or Pentecost, with its rest of faith. Their year Sabbath, 7 times 7 = 49, introducing the 50th, or Jubilee year. The still larger cycle of 50 times 50, marking the millennium as Earth's great Jubilee. And now finally, we find the Sabbath, or 7-day system, on a still larger scale, measuring Earth's creation from its inception to its perfection, to be 7 times 7,000 years, equaling 49,000 years, ushering in the grand epoch when there shall be no more sighing, no more crying, no more pain, no more dying, because God's work of creation shall have been completed, far as this earth is concerned. No wonder that day should be marked as a Jubilee.